Worried about letting someone else pick out the perfect avocado for your perfect impress them on the third date guacamole? Well, good thing Instacart shoppers are as picky as you are. They find ripe avocados like it's their guac on the line. They are milk expiration date detectives. They bag eggs like the 12 precious pieces of cargo they are. So let Instacart shoppers overthink your groceries so that you can overthink what you'll wear on that third date. Download the Instacart app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Hello, hello, hello. It is now 7:09 here at WCCO. Yes, you are listening to Steele Talking, and I'm your host, Geralyn Steele. You know it's what I love to do is sit here and gab with you. Oh, we got a lot to talk about tonight. Oh, my God. The president did everything but give somebody the finger. What is going on? We'll talk about that later in the show. Stay tuned, honey. Buckle up. Here we go. Woo! We even have the team back together. Jonathan Lowe is in studio with us tonight. In fact, he's going to stay with me throughout the whole show,
assembled,
or most of it.
News team assembled.
Assembled. And of course, the one you know and love, Susie Jones from our newsroom, is right across. How you doing, sister girlfriend?
I am marvelous.
I'm marvelous also. Even though there's craziness going on.
Crazy.
I am marvelous. Hey, are you on Facebook?
I am.
Right? And do people send you messages now saying, you know, share this, you know, it's a prayer that goes out, or share this because it's a notice they want you to know about, or a scam, or do you get that?
Yes, all the time.
I can't stand it.
No.
I mean, it
you
is
you don't
just,
share much?
I don't even want to be on Messenger anymore because you never know. You open up something from a relative and all of a sudden it says, please share this with everybody. They need to know. And, you know, it's crazy. Please stop doing that.
All right.
Please, please, please stop doing that. Okay, so here's the news.
Okay.
So today, I went to church.
Bless your heart.
I know, right?
You went for me and Jonathan.
Girl, I needed to go. I needed to go. Everybody needed to go for Jonathan. In fact, here's a notice.
Ah!
Everybody needs to go to church just for Jonathan. I don't care what faith you are. Y'all pray with some beads
listen,
or something.
I mean,
we need the
Holy
listen,
Rosary.
Listen,
everything.
Listen,
Hail Mary.
Buddha. Everything. Just
listen,
full of grace.
He needs it.
People of Minnesota and people around the 50,000 watts of WCCO radio. I just want you to listen for a second to my side of the story.
Well, he's eating his dinner. He's going to get on
exactly.
the radio.
No,
I'm
he's going to say that he works on Sundays.
No, this is my side of the story.
Okay.
She ain't lying.
I see? Bravo! Oh, honey, God heard you.
See?
You're going to get a rhinestone in your crown.
Mm.
Speaking of crowns.
Yes.
I wore one today.
You did?
At church, I did. Now, let me explain that. Okay, so growing up, black women would wear these huge hats to church, and they were called crowns.
They're beautiful.
They are fantastic, right? My mother has just like almost a room filled. I mean, really, she has so many of
these. Does she wear her hats?
Oh, my gosh. She wore one today. Are you kidding me?
What color was it?
All the time. Today it was black. And so my sister decided with her church choir that we were doing all a cappella songs. So I wasn't there as a featured guest. I was just there as part of the ensemble, right? And so we sang all of these, you know, a cappella tunes, and they had wooden boards out so we could stomp our heels on it, honey, and make it real loud, right? Exactly. So I wore a crown. Girl, it was yellow. It must have been 6 feet wide. That's what it felt like on my head. I actually got a glimpse of myself on the video. I just need you to know. It was, girl, wait. I am officially a church girl.
Yes,
don't
you
say
are.
Anything, Jonathan. Just continue to eat your dinner.
Praise
don't
God.
Don't say anything.
Yeah, not a word.
I am a church girl.
Yes,
I look
are.
Just like a church girl, right? So I
try
to keep it on the whole service. Girl,
did it hurt your head?
Look, you know, it hurt. I was having a flash. Do you hear me? A flat. You cannot be pausing with a hat on. Okay? You can't be cute.
No, you can't.
I thought I was glistening. I look at the screen and I see myself. I'm pouring.
You're hot.
Pouring. Do you wear hats?
I do not.
Never?
Nope.
I didn't either till today.
You lie.
I wear a baseball hat when I'm golfing with Jonathan.
She wore one on Wednesday when we went out golfing together. She wore a baseball cap.
That's right. She usually goes with you and
Steve Thompson
and Chris Elston. Hi, it's Chris.
He's great.
Good.
I miss him. Oh, my gosh. I'm so glad that he's happy.
He's
His
alive,
family's
people.
Doing well.
He's alive out there in CC.
He's
alive.
He's doing great.
He's really doing well. He's successful with Lindness Construction.
I know. It's like, bravo, Chris. He deserves it. He's a great guy.
Getting back to the hats.
You always have one on.
Always.
I usually do.
Show us your hair today, by the way. Do you have hair?
I do have a little bit. I shaved right before.
No, no, no.
Right
can
before,
I see it, like, seriously?
I shaved right before we went out. I'm trying to lift this up with while keeping my headphones on. I'm trying
while
to
while eating dinner.
Oh,
while eating tell. Dinner.
Yes,
it looks like a shadow multitasking. Or something. It looks like a shadow.
It's what
it's
what us Gen X slash millennials do.
Have you ever had, like, a? Did you ever get sunburned?
I've been sunburned.
You have?
Mm. Yeah, I'd say I have. I've peeled. I have peeled.
I have, too.
Yeah. Mm.
I thought I had a disease. I think I told you that, Susie.
You did?
Did I tell you? I thought I had a disease. I didn't know what it was. I just need y'all to know.
You're not white.
I seriously did.
Did you know you're not white?
Skin falling off of my body.
I wasn't white. I did not. I'm honest to God. I'm going to tell you this ignorance of mine. I actually thought black people did not burn like that unless fire hit me. Fire.
That's a whole kind of. That's a whole kind of. That's Cajun crispy burning. That's a whole different.
Cajun my goodness.
Crispy. Yes. Oh my God. So I have you. Have you? Actually,
do you need to ask me that? I have red hair and freckles. I've
know,
been burned
exactly.
so many times.
So what do you do to prepare for the sun? Because, like, the sun is changing right now because we're in the fall season and we have these really hot days.
You don't want to ask me about sun.
Really?
I don't wear sunscreen. My sisters are mad at me. My mom.
You don't?
The dermatologist. She's like, tell me you wear something. I said, well, sometimes.
I read that they actually put a certain ingredient in the sunscreen.
Yeah.
That
makes you stupid?
That makes you burn. So you have to put more on. Maybe that's my problem. If I had just taken the sunscreen. I don't know. I actually burned and didn't know what it was.
That would
I started
be,
peeling.
Be the
I thought,
most,
oh, my God, my face is melting.
If that happened, that would be the most subversive, ingenious item. You know, it's like things that are put in food to make you hungry.
Mm-hmm.
Or things that
Diet
are
Diet Coke does that.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Things that are put in beverages or
cigarettes.
Right.
Name it. Yeah.
So it's like, you know, you eat pretzels. You don't eat pretzels without having, you know, some sort of beverage, whether
which
it's beer
really
or something.
Ticks me off.
And so
can
you can't have
say,
the pretzels without having the beer, and you can't have the beer without having the pretzels.
Or the McDonald's French fries. Remember that whole scandal when they were like frying them in oil with sugar? Just remember, they dip them or soak them in sugar water, and then they put them in the oil. I mean, I was addicted to them for years.
French
There's
fries.
A reason for that.
McDonald's French fries.
You just, oh my Lord.
There is a genius in it, even though it's
evil.
It's evil.
Yes.
Okay, so here's the way to break yourself if you are addicted of McDonald's French fries. Eat them when they're cold.
Oh, yeah, they're nasty.
They're horrible.
And you can't warm them up.
You can't warm them up.
In the microwave.
Not the microwave, but the oven you can.
Could.
Oh, we shouldn't have told them that.
So are you going to talk about this standing kneeling controversy tonight?
I'm absolutely talking about that at 8 o'clock.
What do you think of that?
First of all, can we just talk about our president?
Do you want to?
Honestly, I'm so offended. I'm so offended. I want him out of the office. I want him out. And I cannot believe that a president would say, you know, that he's a son of a bee. Mm-hmm. Like it was nothing. Mm-hmm. Like that just rolls off the tongue of the president of the United States. And, you know, I know that we've had examples of presidents before that loved to curse in the White House, but you just did not hear them on national television necessarily cursing like that. I don't understand it. I do not receive it. My heart is not open.
Mm. I think it was somewhat of a ridiculous, just the whole controversy. It's just sort of like I want to scream and say there are much bigger things that we need to be paying attention to. Now, I get it. Constitutional rights, First Amendment, you can have your spot on that. But really, in the big picture of prioritizing what needs to be handled in the United States and the world, I mean, there are still people at Harvey in Texas that are covered in mud.
Right.
There are people in Florida. There are people in Puerto Rico. I mean, Mexico's got
Saint
an earthquake.
Croix, yep.
You know, there's
Saint
a
Thomas.
Lot. We have problems.
Yeah, we have problems, but we will always have problems. My biggest challenge is seriously that this president has started this fight, and it's an unnecessary fight, and if we have bigger problems that we need to be dealing with, then, Mr. President, do it.
I don't think
do your job.
I don't think he's listening.
Well, do your job.
Okay. Tweet back at him. He likes to tweet.
You should not have asked me that
question. I'm sorry.
I'm for a clip.
Who are you talking to next?
I am. Oh, my goodness. I have a guest coming on. His name is Jim Showalter.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, we're going to talk about the Graham Cassidy health care bill. And how much is this costing us? If we were to take down Obamacare and put up Trump care, how much is that going to cost us?
You can't ask me that.
That's craziness.
I'm at the end of my shift.
Well, I'm absolutely going to ask him.
You should. He's a good man.
He's a good man.
All right.
We're going to take a break, and we'll be back in a moment.
Have a beautiful night.
Thanks, Susie.
Welcome to Play It, a new podcast network featuring radio and TV personalities talking business, sports, tech, entertainment, and more. Play it at play.it.
It is now 7:20 here at CCO. This is Taylor Swift, right? I actually like her writing. So there you go. Welcome back. You are listening to Steele Talking, and I'm your host, Geraldine Steele. As promised, my first guest, we're going to talk about the whole Graham Cassidy health bill. His name is Jim Showalter. He's a former cabinet member in the Dayton administration and currently is the president and CEO of Minnesota Council of Health Plans. And he's joining me to discuss it. How are you, sir? How are you?
I am great. Pleased to be with you.
Really appreciate you joining us. Okay. We've heard a lot about this whole Graham Cassidy health bill, but how will it affect Minnesotans?
We can go on a lot of different things, but the first thing is it's just going to take coverage away from a lot of people. They're not going to be able to get the services that they get in through state public programs. Individual insurance market's going to become more unstable. There are just a lot of problems that are going to come where people aren't going to be able to afford the coverage and get the services they need.
I'm blown away at how long it took for us to finally get Obamacare installed and people really signing up for it. And it was been doing really well here in the state of Minnesota. And now they're talking about dismantling one and putting up another. How much is that going to cost us? Do you know?
Well, that's one of those issues. The CBO, the Congressional Budget Office, is supposed to do those numbers.
Right. Which we're supposed to have that by what, Friday?
Yeah. So we're sort of waiting. And you know, I used to do budget numbers for the state. And you always want to know exactly what you're going to do before you pass it into law.
Mm-hmm.
And right now, this bill, the actual cost, the number of people who are going to lose insurance, those things are still to be determined.
That seemed like it should be like at the top of the list of things to talk about. Every time we hear about Graham Cassidy, that question should come up. How much is it going to cost the taxpayers? But it doesn't.
No, in part because it's basically saying it's going to save the federal government. The federal government's going to save money. It's the states, it's individuals who need care, it's people who provide services, it's small businesses who won't be able to get insurance products. It's all of those people who are going to have the lost money. They're going to find the cost.
You know, states' rights has been a problem. We've been there, done that. Didn't work out. That's why it changed. It feels like this administration just keeps trying to pull us backwards.
Well, you know, there's always been a lot of tension about healthcare. You know, it is a hard thing. It's personal. And it costs a lot of money, and so the politics around it are really tough.
But if it's anything, it should be personal.
Yeah, and that's exactly it. And so public policy, always try to find some simple way of handling your problems, my problems, and everyone else who's listening. And it's like, there's no simple way. You're going to have to step back, set some fair rules, and do it gradually. And this bill is anything but gradual.
How do you think the majority of Americans are going to look at this? Do you think that this is, even if it passes, that we'll be okay with it? We'll just sit back and, you know, rest and go, well, there it is. We'll just have to change and figure it out.
No.
No.
No, I think one of the features that it would unleash is that states would really have to create new programs, like whole new programs serving hundreds of thousands of people in each state in a matter of 2 years. Yeah, I helped work on Minsure. I know how hard it was just to get that simple program, that simple infrastructure up in the course of a year. Doing programs for all of Medicaid recipients, elderly people, disabled people, poor people who need health care, it's like that's a lot of complex issues, and every state, 50 times over, would have to do it in 2 years.
Okay, here's what I don't understand, Jim. We are all better if all of us are healthier, period. If all of us have our vaccinations, if all of us are able to walk in and get help with any diseases we have, that means when I'm riding the bus with you, walking next to you, shopping with you, we are all healthier because of that. Why is it that this particular Republican Party does not seem to get it?
I'm not sure, but I think part of it is numbers. Some people cost a lot in healthcare. It's not like everyone costs the same amount to get their healthcare in a given year. You know, we find that, you know, for most groups, about 3% of the people create about 50% of the medical bills.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's what we found out for people who buy insurance on their own. So as a result, it's kind of that rock and a hard place where I think the Republicans here are saying, well, we can just trim because if we have fewer people getting health care, they'll figure it out and their health care costs won't be so much. There's a little bit of truth to it, but you don't know who's going to be sick in any given year.
Exactly. It could be any one of us at any time. One accident. We're all one accident away from living in a hospital for, you know, years trying to get straight. Let me ask you finally about pre-existing conditions. How do we define that? Because as far as I'm concerned, we are all born with pre-existing conditions of some sort, whether it's a crooked back or maybe you have a leg that's longer than the other one, or there's something wrong with your esophagus, or, you know, we could go on and on and on. So how is it defined?
You know, the pre-existing conditions basically is something that if you needed medical treatment to treat that pre-existing condition before you bought insurance, well, then you could be kind of sort of roped out, so you wouldn't be able to get services. So if I had a heart attack, theoretically, you can't now. But, you know, in the future, you could be underwritten. So he's like, well, if Showalter has any more heart problems, you know, sorry, that we're not going to cover that. That's the kind of thing that means that if you've had a bad health history or have had some problems, you might have more expensive care ahead. And all of a sudden, your insurance becomes so expensive, you can't pay for it.
But how likely is it that the majority of Americans would not have pre-existing conditions?
Well, probably not. I think your comment that everyone has some pre-existing conditions, right? But the ones that insurers would say no to or would underwrite and put into a high-risk pool are a lot more selective. But the point is that once you get into that, it's going to be so expensive that nobody could afford it. And it's going to be a bad, bad process where more and more people will drop out. And their costs are going to be basically showing up at the health, the hospital, emergency room, and all of a sudden, nobody's going to quite know how we're paying for anything anymore.
We've been there, done that, too. It's just amazing to me. And as we sit here and watch it, we also know that the states can choose how they want to do it. So every state can be different. So if I'm driving from Los Angeles to Minneapolis, and all of a sudden something happens to me and I need care, whatever state I stop in could make all the difference, correct?
Yes, totally right. And a good friend of mine has a son with a severe health problems. In fact, he's passed away in the past year. And she lived in one state, and they actually couldn't move until then the ACA passed. And at that point, her husband already had another job in another state, and finally they were able to move because up until that point, she wasn't sure he could get any services. He wouldn't qualify. He'd be one of those people with pre-existing conditions.
Unbelievable. Sir, I have to ask you, if there was one thing you wanted listeners to know tonight, since you are the president and CEO of the Minnesota Council of Health Plans, what would you want them to know about health plans if this Graham Cassidy bill goes through?
You know, I think the thing that I'd want everyone to know is that if this bill were to go through, there would have to be a ton of work and attention paid to it, because insurance doesn't get cheap just because of a bill. Insurance helps people pay medical bills. And until we figure out a hot way to stop prescription drugs from costing so much, until we find a way to slow down the rise of medical costs, we're not going to make progress. And we've got to work on that, not finding out ways to carve people out.
Unbelievable. Thank you so much for joining us tonight, Jim. I appreciate it.
You bet. Thank you.
All right. That is Jim Showalter. And again, he is a former cabinet member in the Dayton administration, and currently is the president and CEO of the Minnesota Council of Health Plans. Bottom line is, stay on top of this. We may be again in for the fight of our lives. We'll be back in just a moment. It is now 7:35 here at WCCO. Welcome back to Steel Talking. I am your host, Geraldine Steele. I really do love this song. I haven't heard this song in a while, so thank you for playing this. Jonathan Lowe is in studio, waiting to take your calls. Anytime you'd like to join our conversation, you are welcome to do so. But please know that at 8:05, we are having open phones, and you get a chance. We're going to talk about what has happened in sports, and we're going to talk about some of the other subjects we are attacking tonight. So you're welcome to call us at 651-503-8547. Well, this half hour, I'm very excited. I've asked to talk about this now for a few months, and it's finally happening. Our fellow Americans in Puerto Rico are losing everything, their homes, businesses, and a way of life. Well, a group of international scientists had the forethought to think of doomsday scenarios just like this one, or the one that happened with Harvey, or the one that's happening with Maria, and how it would affect agriculture. And they came up with a way to ensure our food supply would survive and thrive in order to replenish the crops around the world. Well, Phil Pardee is professor and director, International Science and Technology, Practice and Policy. It's called INSTEP. It's a center at the University of Minnesota. It is an internationally recognized, he is an internationally recognized expert on agriculture, and he's joining me to talk about the Doomsday Seed Vault. Welcome in studio. Really appreciate you coming in tonight.
Thank you. Delightful to be here.
I'm sure you probably get a lot of questions about this seed vault these days, now that our world seems to be changing right before our eyes.
Yes, there's a renewed concern about the sort of natural basis for agriculture, and particularly very fragile aspects of that natural base, particularly the plants that we grow and use to feed ourselves and our livestock. So and renewed concerns specifically around those, yes.
So let me give a little bit of history on this. Since its inception, the University of Minnesota has understood the critical importance of protecting and sustaining the world's natural resources. But with our ever-growing global population, this has been a huge challenge. In fact, in 1950, the world population was about 2.5 billion people, and now it's 7.5 billion. Wow, what a difference, right? And the Department of Plant Pathology at the University of Minnesota has been very successful in the 20th century and continues today. In fact, Borlaug Hall, built in 1983, was it, Phil? Do you
yes.
know?
Yep.
1983, harbored greats like Sir Bent, is it Scovemond?
Scovemond, yes.
Scovemond, who worked with Norman E. Borlaug, and later he became a world leader in genetic preservation of crop plants and headed the, let me make sure I get this right, the Nordic Genetic Resource Center. Scovemond also helped establish the Svalbard Global Seed Vault, or the Doomsday Seed Vault, near the Arctic Circle. Now, it's known as the Doomsday Vault, this seed bank operated by the Norwegian government and containing a seed of just about every known crop in the world. It's meant to be humanity's backup in the event of a catastrophe that devastates crops. Wow. So do I have that right so far, sir?
Right on.
Okay. So how is the vault then, Phil? How is it doing, and is it capable of doing exactly what it was built to do when needed?
Yeah, it's doing fine. It was it grew out of a concern of a need for sort of a fail-safe system to store these seeds. These seeds had been stored for many, many years. You mentioned Norman Borlaug and Bent Scovemond, who are both graduates from the St. Paul campus of the University of Minnesota. Mm-hmm. And they worked for a group of international research centres dotted around the world. Both of those individuals worked for a centre down just out of Mexico City, actually.
Oh, wow.
Called CIMMYT, the International Maize and Wheat Improvement Centre. And they did a lot of work to produce high-yielding wheat and corn varieties that spread throughout the world and actually forestalled. When I was in agriculture in the 60s and 70s, there was lots of concerns about mass starvation globally. But we've had whilst we've still got a lot of hungry people on the planet, those mass starvation scenarios were basically forestalled by the efforts of centres and individuals like Norman Bent. And in the process of developing these new seed varieties, they started storing both the historical varieties on which the new crops are bred from, but also the new varieties that they grow. And there is, in fact, a gene bank down just out of Mexico City. And I guess the events of this past week show the potential vulnerability of these systems because there was a nearby earthquake. And
right.
These gene banks need to be stored. These genetic material need to be stored in gene banks with very controlled, low humidity conditions and very low temperatures. They're actually stored at around 0 degrees Fahrenheit to maintain their longevity over a long period of time. It's not like putting books in a library. These are little living entities, and when you put them in a gene bank, they're still metabolizing, and so you need to slow down their metabolic rate. So you can store them in these conditions for upwards of 50 to 100 years.
Mm-hmm.
But you need to put them in places that don't have earthquakes and intrinsically cold. And so that's what gave rise to the idea of not doing away with the gene banks like the one down in Mexico City or similar ones over in Los Baños in the Philippines for the International Rice Research Institute, but having a system where there is a backup system. So if those sort of frontline systems fail, these genetic material can can be withdrawn from those backup facilities like at Svalbard in Norway.
So we could see more seed vaults around the globe.
I think this seed vault's been built for the long term. It's got it's got a very large capacity, which is and so it can take a lot more seed samples in it. It currently stores nearly a million seed samples, which is quite a staggering.
I thought it was more than that.
Yeah.
I actually thought it was more than that. So a million, wow.
Yeah. But it can handle probably 2 to 3 times more than that. And it's not it's fairly costly to maintain these seeds, and so it needs a fair bit of care and attention. And so I think this one's got a fairly long life ahead of it. It's grown, it's been developed in a place that's just barely 800 miles south of the North Pole. So it is pretty darn cold. In fact, I Googled it earlier this afternoon, and just after noon today, it was 37 degrees Fahrenheit at this facility. And the facility itself is burrowed into the side of a mountain,
right,
so it's literally
remarkable.
Surrounded by permafrost.
Mm-hmm.
It's in a tectonic free zone, so it's not subject to earthquakes and the like, and it's very isolated, so that it helps for security and so forth.
But we are losing permafrost.
We are definitely losing permafrost, and in fact, the seed vault had an incident earlier this year where they had a much warmer than normal spring late last year, which gave rise to some water creeping into just the entrance of the... It didn't get anywhere near the vault, but it got into the entrance of the system and caused a bit of concern. But, you know, the question is that a one-off or a repeat event, and how frequent are those repeat events likely to happen?
Yeah, you know, as I was reading articles, I was researching, they said, oh, my goodness, thank you guys so much. You gave us the whole doomsday seed vault, and now it's flooding. Gee, thanks, because, of course, seeds in a flood, they don't go together.
That is correct, yeah.
Okay, 50 to 100 years. That could pass very quickly because we've had remarkable technological advancements when it comes to plant pathology in the last 50 years.
Mm-hmm.
And so to know that it's 50 to 100 years that you're expecting these seeds to be able to last and be viable, correct?
Correct.
But it could take longer than that before
sure.
some doomsday scenario comes.
Sure, and the idea is, and in typical seed banks, you monitor how the viability of these seeds, and when their viability starts to degrade, then you grow them out again, reproduce them, and then put them back in the seed vault. So it's a process that has been developed probably over the last 80 or 100 years.
100 years?
To develop. And so some systems even use cryogenic systems. Here in Fort Collins, Colorado, which is where the National Gene Bank for the USDA sits, they use a lot of cryopreservation techniques.
For plants?
For plants and animal material as well.
Wow. I keep asking myself, if we have this vault, in case there's a doomsday scenario, who is going to plant them? So are they planning at this doomsday vault, are they planning to have families stay there? And they would be the ones if we had some unusual event, disaster happen where maybe the sun does something and burns off a mile deep into our crust, into the earth, that would destroy so much of the soil. Is it room for families to be there so they would be the ones to reseed the earth?
It's a pretty isolated facility, and it's on an island hundreds of miles north of the mainland of Norway. It's remotely monitored, so it's not a place it's really particularly habitable. So the name Doomsday comes from the notion that it is the sort of last resort place where one would go to get these seeds. I think the scenarios you're describing.
And I love that we have a plan.
Yeah. And this was a lot of foresight by a lot of folks. The gene banks down at Simmet, they've been going for well over half a century.
Mm-hmm.
So people have, even in the US here, have been collecting seeds for well over and storing seeds for well over a century.
Let's talk about collecting seeds for a moment because, look, this was based on a disaster happening. However, in 2015, a withdrawal from the seed bank was made by Syria, I believe, right?
Correct.
And it was not caused by natural disaster. It was caused by war. And this was not the intention of the vault. So when Syria made the withdrawal, was money exchanged? Did they have to go in and rent the seeds and have to plant them, harvest them, and bring seeds back?
No, the seed vault itself was built by the Norwegian government and paid for by the Norwegian taxpayers.
As well as several other countries, though, that are involved.
Correct. The actual operations of the vault are maintained by a crop diversity trust fund, and that trust fund is underwritten by a number of agencies, and a big donor to that is the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation.
Right.
So it's a trust fund that sits under the auspices of a UN agreement by the Food and Agricultural Organization and has an international board of oversight.
And so the G20 are involved?
Yeah, and okay. G20 countries. Mm-hmm. But they pay for the operation of the gene bank. So actually depositing seeds and maintaining those seeds in there are free to the person who deposits them. And it was a free distribution to the government of
So Syria had deposited them and they could just go in and collect?
Well, no, it was seeds that were deposited, some from Syria, but some from other parts of the planet as well. And it's one of the things that people don't realise. It's not just the seeds per se, but it's the information about where in the world those seeds come from, because you can't just take seeds from one location necessarily and plant them somewhere else in the world, because plants get well adapted to the location in which they're grown. Mm-hmm. So you have to go through a process of matching which particular seeds would be right to plant in Syria, and they're not necessarily the same seeds that would be okay to plant, say, in a part of the US.
So, however, we've had some challenges with that. Even Disney proved that there were different ways to take seeds from around the world and grow them, you know, whether it's hanging upside down in midair or what have you. So there have been so many experiments across the world dealing with the seeds that were birthed in one place and to bring them to a whole other environment to see if they would thrive.
Sure, and that's the history of agriculture is the international movement of seeds around the planet.
I mean,
the modern wheat varieties came from what's called the Fertile Crescent. So that's Israel, Jordan, Syria area. Modern maize varieties came from Central America, and we get our potatoes from the Andean highlands in Peru. Soybeans come from China. So we've definitely been moving plant material around the planet for thousands of years. It's just that trying to optimize the yield of those plants needs much more careful matching of the environment to the genetics. And we certainly need to be careful about that because, as you mentioned, we're now 7.5 billion people on the planet, projected to be another 2 billion by 2050.
Not so far away.
And so we have to make sure that when we plant these seeds out, we're really optimizing their productivity, their yields, and to do that in a sustainable fashion. And so we're spending a lot of attention on our campus sort of focused on those aspects.
Well, the University of Minnesota has done remarkable work on plant pathology, and to know that disease has plagued those seeds for many, 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 hundreds of years, really. We have learned a lot about disease, the predators of certain seeds and that sort of thing. And they have been, some of these seeds have been genetically modified, but I'm learning that everything has been genetically modified, you know?
Right. I think the way I look at it as a scientist is that I talk to my students and say the definition of agriculture is the domestication of plants and animals, and that's another way of saying that's human-manipulated genetics in plants and animals. So we invented agriculture roughly 10,000 years ago when we took very weedy-looking species, which are the precursors to, say, our modern wheats, and started selecting them. And selecting them means you're changing the genetic composition. Mm-hmm. And so, yes, you're right, Jacqueline. We've been, you know, genetically modifying plants for their food plants for their eternity. We've only used modern science to modify those plants for the last 100 years. We only rediscovered Mendel's laws of heredity in 1900. Mm-hmm. So for the 9,000 years prior to that, we were doing it by hit or miss, by, you know, astute farmers sort of choosing a particular variety to save to plant for the next season that performed really well in one season. Mm-hmm. And it's only since 1900 that we've sort of understood the laws of heredity and how plants and pathogens interact with each other. And you're right, our university is probably the global leader of thinking about the interplay between the race between plants and pathogens. There's this sort of co-evolutionary dance that goes on. And so as we build in resistance into a particular pest into a plant, Mother Nature's inclination for the pest side is to try and invent its way around that resistance.
Right.
So it induces mutations in those insects and those diseases such that they overcome the resistance that's built into the plant.
But how are they working with us?
Yes, so we get the same sort of issue when we have our annual flu vaccine. The flu vaccine evolves over time, and so we have to replace our flu vaccine from time to time. So we have to collect a lot of information to monitor not just how well the plants do in a particular location, but how the pathology of those plants are evolving and the pests evolving around them. Mm-hmm. And we're very fortunate here in Minnesota. We have the USDA's National Cereal Disease Lab sitting on the St. Paul campus. And we've got some of the world's leading experts in this area. And we've been, frankly, ground zero for a major new pathogen problem that arose in wheat plants in the late 1990s. since we invented wheat, Mother Nature invented a thing called stem rust, which is just a fungal spore that infects wheat. And so for eons, farmers have been fighting against this disease. And so about 100 years ago, we started to figure out how to sort of mollify the effects of this disease. But in 1999, an entirely new variant of this disease popped up in Uganda. It's called UG99. And I've seen it. I've been out in Eastern Africa, and it devastates farmers' fields when it hits, and it's a really virulent disease. And we're vulnerable to that disease here in Minnesota and the upper Midwest.
Our wheat is vulnerable. But our wheat, I just want to make sure I understand. So how are we doing the research, not just on the seeds, but are we also looking at the humans that are consuming those seeds? Fruit of those seeds.
In what respect? So looking at the are we
finding that there are more diseases that humans are getting because of the genetically modified foods, because we're protecting the seeds from the disease and that sort of thing? But are we also looking at protecting humans to make sure that we don't get some different type of mutation or some different type of disease from those that are being treated?
Sure. No, there's been lots of work, not just here but around the globe, on looking at the nutrition and health consequences of genetically modified crops.
There's
absolutely no scientific evidence that there's any.
But they are looking into it.
A lot of effort in that regard.
Phil, I wish we had more time. Thank you so much for joining us tonight. I really appreciate it.
Been a pleasure.
Welcome to Play It, a new podcast network featuring radio and TV personalities talking business, sports, tech, entertainment, and more. Play it at play.it.
It is now 7:56. Let's make that 7:56 here at WCCO. Welcome back. That was an interesting conversation, and we've learned a lot this hour, haven't we? Of course, we initially started out, and I said, I'm a church girl, period. That's how I'm going to define myself, whether I like it or not. Second of all, we talked about Graham Cassidy, right? The health bill. They're going to vote on this. They have until Friday to do this. And, of course, even Senator Ted Cruz came out today saying that as it is, he's probably not going to, you know, he's more likely not to vote for. But we'll see about that. Bottom line is, you know, when you take Obamacare away and you add Trump care, that's a whole nother story, isn't it? Can you imagine how long that's going to take us to deal with that and then to try to find health insurance all over again? Unbelievable. Also, what did we learn when it came to the seed vault? I've been wanting to talk about that for so long. So, Jimmy Erickson, thank you so much for making that possible tonight. He was a great guest. I do hope to have him on again. The bottom line is that it's there for a doomsday situation, but because of war and so much more, that sometimes you have to take the seeds a lot sooner than you know, right? I do like the idea of having the seeds than not having the seeds available, but who will plant them? Who will seed them? How is that plan going to be unfold? Who will live in the vault? Those are the questions I didn't get answers to, but hopefully in the future I'll be able to bring that to you. Stay tuned. Coming up next is you. We get a chance to talk about all that's in the news, and there is a lot. You want to talk about everyone kneeling or not kneeling for the Star Spangled Banner? 651-989-9226.
We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of four amazing new iPhone 15s, and each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s? It's better
over here. Only at T-Mobile, get four iPhone 15s on us and four lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of four lines for $25 per line per month with auto pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto pay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. See T-Mobile.com.